Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. I'm doing a cold open, not to give any updates or, you know, wisdom, not that I have a ton of wisdom or just thoughts, updates, whatever. I wanted to address the fact that I make one of my biggest pronunciation mistakes ever, and that's saying a lot. Pretty much every episode, if you listen, you will hear a screw up, and you can always tell because I pause a little bit. There's probably a couple more uhs. I stutter. You can almost sense the insecurity. And that's especially true when I'm talking to people from outside of North America, people that, you know, would have names that I just don't normally encounter. Even though I screw up all names, it gets even worse if, you know, you're somewhere in Portugal or Chile or, you know, certain parts of France. Anyway, this one should not be hard. My interview, by the way, I should probably have mentioned that off the top. Mount Veeder Winery is an incredible Napa Mountain Cabernet Merlot. Like, they do some great Cabernets. And actually, I've been on a run of a lot of more wineries from the Napa area. Part of it was just going there for my birthday way back in the day. And I'm just on a run of it. And I'm really enjoying doing it, even with, you know, stupid tariffs. And we can't get their wines here in Canada right now. I make some great mistakes. The interview is with the winemaker for Veeder, and that is John Giannini. I screw up. I call him Gianni or Gianni. I'm not even close. Now, that's a mistake, you know, I've made many times in the past. I'm part Italian. That doesn't matter. I will screw up names that sound Italian, that are Italian adjacent. I'll find ways. I screw up every nation in the world. But then I kept calling it Mount Veeder. It's Mount Veeder. That's the winery. And in the middle of it, Alyssa, who is so good, Nike Communications, who has helped put together some of these interviews, she just put a very polite little message in the Zoom saying, there's an issue, or can we, pronunciation we have to go over. I mean, it wasn't even that. It was just, hey, there may be an issue with the pronunciation. So I asked John, and he is so nice. You'll hear this about 16 minutes or so in. He could not have been more polite. He went, oh, my name gets screwed up all the time. And he actually said, oh, you did a pretty good job. I didn't. I did such a horrible job. I decided to record a cold open to apologize to John, to his family, to his ancestors, to all the good people at Mount Veeder that have been making wine for so long. You know, the family, the Bernstein family, they started this like in the sometime in the 70s, and they used to work with Mondavi, and they're a really cool story. They were like the first, I think, to plant Cab Franc, like the family. The first to plant Petit Verdot. Excuse me. You know, this family is so intertwined in the history of California wine, and Mount Veeder is. And I called it Veeder. Oh, I like this one. I felt extra shame, and it takes a lot because I've got a pretty good force field after being so bad at pronouncing names. Anyway, so that's all I wanted to do was to give a shout out to John because he could not have been more polite, and it could have been really awkward. And I leave it all in. I try to leave almost everything but from the podcast, from an interview in. So anyway, from Mount Veeder, here is my interview with the winemaker, John Giannini.
The title is clunky, but the wine talk is smooth. You're listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. My guest, winemaker for a very well-known, very famous California winery, Mount Veeder Winery, John Giannini is joining me. John, good afternoon. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
So am I. I mean, you know, as we record this at this moment, it's hard to get California wine in Toronto, but eventually that will change. And actually, I can still find some of your wines at the odd restaurant. Let's start here. And we'll get into all things Mount Veeder and mountain fruit and Cabernet. And I'm curious about your Merlot as well. How did you get started in this business?
My start in the wine business was my start in the restaurant business. So I come through a restaurant background. Started in the restaurant, I think it was 1995 full-time. I was going to school part-time and working as a server, or at that point we were called waiters. I worked in a small friend of mine had an Italian trattoria. I worked it for him a few days a week and kind of got into wine a little bit there. But then eventually I turned to the kitchen because that was more my passion. I definitely like to help out when I could, and then worked my way into the production side, into the kitchen side. So I was there. Then I think my restaurant job in San Francisco around 1997, worked at a place called Scala's Bistro, right off of Union Square. It was great staff, super fun. It was right before Bourdain ruined it all with his book about restaurants and pulled the curtain back. I think he came out in 99 maybe. And this was the heyday of, like, before everyone knew how much fun working in the restaurant. It was very stressful and a lot of work, but it was a lot of fun. And there was a server there, my friend Tony. He was the one who that was the spark for sure. He knew a couple of us in the kitchen were interested on the wine side as well as food, obviously. And he would once in a while walk by the pass and just drop a glass of wine and kind of blurt out what it was, vintage and wine. And we would kind of stash it away. Every night we would just try different wines. After work, he would take us out sometimes, and we would, just taste mostly. And he was into California Cabernets at that time. This was, there was 90, it was probably the 94 vintage. 94 was out. That's where we kind of started. Because it was like 90, 96, 97, 98. I was at Scala's. So he was pretty pivotal. And then he would also come up to Napa quite a bit. Whoever had a car that time living in San Francisco, they would be tasked with driving us up to Napa for visits, and he would be picking up wine. I remember going to Etude back in the night, like late 90s. We went to Zinsky. He would pick up wine. This guy was on all the list at that time before it was cool, or was much easier to get on some of those lists, like Colgan and Harlan. He'd get 3 bottles or 6 bottles, and he would I didn't know you could flip wines at that point, but that's what he was doing before I knew that was a possibility.
So then you got the wine bug then, and it makes sense. You're in San Francisco, you're working in restaurants, so you're working in food and wine. So it's kind of easy to see how you would eventually flow in that direction. By the way, before I ask my next question, what were the prices of Harlan back then versus what they are now?
I can't recall that right away. I remember I was even on the list for Colgan at one point
Okay.
in the late, maybe it was early 2000s or late 90s. I mean, it was $99.
Yeah.
And I had three. And even then, working there, I couldn't afford it. I was on the list. And again, I wasn't didn't know these were wines that you could flip. I was trying to get these wines to start, start to build a cellar, even though I was in the kitchen. And or I could keep one, and someone I would sell to a friend at cost, which was a well, managing money was never my forte. So yeah, there were 90. It was at that point, and then like Schrader was like $75 maybe.
Oh my God.
Colgan and a lot of the cults. I mean, Screaming Eagle at that point was probably still ridiculous, but a lot of those wines had not hit. Again, they're maybe just coming out with the 97 vintage, and that's the one that kind of blew everything up, if I recall.
Yeah, I'm bad at money as well. All the wine I have, I could sell it and make profit, but I'm like, no, this is for quality of life. This, isn't for profit.
Yeah,
So the
it wasn't a business venture for me at the time. I'd sold enough just so I could stay on these lists, and then just through I moved away, changed jobs, and just kind of. And that time there wasn't like COVID. You had to fax in your order. There was no email for that, and some I wasn't. I was technologically hampered. That wasn't my thing either. Very analog, and that's I just kind of fell off a bunch of lists. Right now I look back, and that was not a very bright thing to do, but it happened.
Anyone under the age of 30, Google what a fax is. It was a
Yeah.
real thing. So
Yeah.
then at that point, do you go to school? Do you just start mentoring or, just working as an apprentice? How do you go from there to learning the
So
craft?
I go from there to San Francisco. Then I came up to the CIA, the cooking school in San Helena, just to take a class or so. I was kind of getting burnt out on the city. It was really fun and the restaurant was amazing, but lifestyle wise, it was too, I needed a break. So I came up to CIA, took a couple classes, and then I did a stage, which for people that don't know is basically free work at Restaurant Terra in San Helena. And Hirosone was a chef. He was James Beard Award winner at that time. The Zagat guide was kind of big. So I at night I went to school during the day, and at night I hung out in his kitchen just to see if I could learn some things. And I did not know someone had given notice maybe on the grill, and it's kind of a it was a tryout. At the end of my couple of days working, he called me the next week and asked if I wanted a job. And so I left San Francisco. I was with the wasn't a sous chef, I was a roundsman. I just gave everyone their days off. So I worked all the stations, and I came up and worked for Hiro at that time at Terra for like in the pantry, kind of started in Garmage. And then that was pretty pivotal. That was 90, was that right at the end of San Francisco, 97, 98. And just kind of was like kind of like starting over, because that was a level of dining that and craftsmanship that I had not seen prior to that. I worked in some really great restaurants, but they were, Scott's were doing like 500 people a night. Here it was dinner only 6 nights a week. You get there 11 in the morning to be ready at 6 o'clock for dinner. It was an amazing experience. But then also living up here, that got me into, I mean, the food and wine being connected, I think that was definitely that was ignited in my San Francisco stay. I mean, we'll talk about this later, but like my family as well was always food and wine. But really the connection and how integral it is to that experience, to the dining and drinking experience, how they're both, I think you need both. That was San Francisco. And then working for Hiro up Terra, that was a whole other level. And then being in Napa, seeing these wines, the producers, winemakers or owners would come in for dinner. And to me, I wasn't awestruck, but it was just interesting to see, we have VIP. I'm like, that's the same name on this label. Okay. Or you see a name comes in, it's like, oh, there's a street named after them in Saint Helena or Yountville. So that was it was still and it has that. I mean, Napa's much bigger now, but even now it's still pretty small relative to, it's a pretty incestuous place. But it was great. It was a great experience. People would send wines back mostly to Hero Chef, but he would share them when he could.
Yeah, and those guys are celebrities, for people like us. You see them, that's a celebrity. That's, absolutely.
Yeah, it was pretty cool. And they were treated as such too, which is nice.
How did you make and when did you make the decision to eventually leave the culinary side and go full on the wine side?
So that was I was at working for Hero. I did a small stint in Portland. Because that restaurant scene was going nuts like 03, 04. Went up there, made it about a year. It was just too cold and rainy for this California kid. I'm native Californian, born and raised. So it was awesome. Met some great people. Restaurants were great, but I didn't. I made it just under a year. Came back and I worked Harvest for a friend of mine, Thomas. I was again kind of burning out in San Francisco, which led to Saint Helena, and then it was kind of. It was it's the restaurant business, it although it's amazing, it teaches you so much how to work. You meet some great people, and but I was burning out being inside. I like the outdoors, and it was just tough being inside for 12 hours a day. And I'd done it for 15 years or so probably, and it was time of change. And my friend Thomas Brown, he was looking for some harvest help. That was 03, so I did a harvest for him in 03. Went up to Portland in 03, 04, didn't make it quite the full year, came back and then did another harvest with him. This is could be it's a timeline's a little confusing here maybe, but then
No, no.
after the 04 harvest I went back to work for Hiro at Terra. So I did two stints there. At that time he was opening a restaurant at the St. Regis in San Francisco in like 04, 05, a restaurant called Ame. So he was going to be down there quite a bit. So I was a chef de cuisine at Terra and like right end of 04, like getting 05 through 06. When he was down, that's when he was spending a lot of time in San Francisco getting that restaurant up and running. And it was amazing. It's no longer there, but he had a good stint down there. And then during 05, on my days off, I would help Thomas out with the, at certain picks. Sometimes I would go to picks and follow the fruit to the winery, or if it was going to a custom crush, just make sure they're picking the right rows. They had bins, ride the bins, pull leaves, this maybe once a week. And I realized I didn't get to partake in the full harvest. So I realized that I didn't want to miss another harvest. I just took a while to tell my chef here that I wasn't going to be there any longer. It was because he was such a big mentor of mine, and he was kind of, it wasn't mad. He was just shocked that I wasn't going to be in the restaurant. Like, you don't want to own your own restaurant? I'm like, no. That's when, after not being in the industry in 05, was that was the impetus to make it a full-time job.
What were those first couple of years for you? Was when you've left something you've done for so long in the culinary world. Now you're going on to on the wine side of things. What were those first couple of years like for you?
I went up and worked at Outpost Wines up in Angwin. So pretty small. It was only, I was employee number two. There was an assistant winemaker. He had another kind of part-time cellar guy. So I started out, I had, a little bit of experience dragging hoses around, mostly, or all harvest experience. So I knew what that kind of energy was like, and the chaos, organized chaos of harvest, and the excitement of harvest. It was, yeah, the rest of the year is much different. It was fun because it was like everything was so new. I looked just like when I started in the restaurant. I mean, every day you're learning something on your own, through books, through someone else. A lot of peers, you're stealing. As my chef here, he said, you got to steal information. People aren't gonna write it down for you. There's recipes. People can tell you how to make one, but like, you're just constantly observing and stealing information from folks. So it was hard, but it was so fun and exciting, and it was a whole new. It was a little scary because I wasn't, at that age where you make a career change, maybe venture again. I think I was in my mid to late 30s. But I didn't have a family at that time, so it wasn't a huge risk. I was just take care of myself. But starting new, starting kind of at the bottom. But when the top is only like, one other person, it's not, and you get to do a lot. So it was so small. You're doing everything from, racking, topping, receiving barrels, winemakers doing the blending, but we have access to all the wines, so you're just constantly tasting, checking out other vineyards and other wineries a lot on either days off, or you try to just sharing knowledge with other folks. A lot of dinners with wine, and got into that community. It was a little bit like the restaurant, but maybe more so as far as people willing to share information. Restaurants are a little more guarded, I think. And in that era, I think now it's more open. But I came up in the restaurant when it was a much different. Still had it was all based on the French Foreign Legion, the inside of the restaurant, as far as the hierarchy, and it still kind of had that. So, but it was difficult, but super fun, and man, you learn so much so quickly.
I want to get to Mount Vidier, but I just thought about something before. You talked about how in the wineries, everyone was more open about sharing information. I wonder if that's because every winemaker I've ever talked to, everyone, there's one trait that everyone shares, and that's curiosity. And I think if you're surrounded by curious people, they don't want to be guarded with their information. They want to share theirs because then they'll probably learn something else as well. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's what came to mind when you said that.
Yeah, I just feel the sharing enough. Yeah, because you're gonna learn from everybody. I mean, that's those first few years, I knew so little that I learned from, we have our interns for harvest, and most of them had more experience than I did. You'd steal something from them. You're always learning. They're gonna, how they did it somewhere else. Doesn't mean you're gonna use it, but you can see how not to do things, see what you like, and again, you can kind of pick and choose what fits your personality or the wines that you like, or you start to build a philosophy. But the philosophy, that again, that changes all the time, because if you're curious and you're just learning from folks, and then a lot of change as far as environment, the market, the wine drinker itself, things change so not so quickly. But now I look, it's been like 16, 17 years. It's changed a lot since I first started.
What do people need to know about Mount Vidier, about the vineyards?
So for in general, just our, and it's we it's Mount Beater. Just a sorry to correct, we that's how we'll pronounce it down here.
Oh, a Vider.
Yes, sorry, I
Okay,
can't remember.
I'm going to pull back the curtain. The
Yeah.
fantastic Alyssa, who works with you guys and a lot of other wineries, just said, can I give a pronunciation correction? And anyone who listens to this podcast knows I mangle names like crazy. I've screwed up my own name on my radio show. And Alyssa has been so polite, because we started this about 18 minutes ago. And just now she says, can I shout out a pronunciation correction? John, let's go over a parade of my shame. One, how bad did I do on your last name?
It was better than most. Better than most. I get a lot of different pronunciations, but it's Giannini.
Oh my God, Giannini. I wasn't even close. You are
that's
so my, nice.
I should have said that's more on me. I should have said something to me, but we had some flow going, so I didn't
First off, that's so nice of you. By the way, this is all staying in the podcast. None of this is getting edited out. And the other one, how about, like, I can't believe I screwed up the name of the winery. I've had your wines a bunch of times here in Toronto.
It's we'll just call it an alternate pronunciation.
Yeah, you're trying to out-polite me. You know, you're trying to out-Canadian me for
the
audience.
Maybe it's accents just on the different syllable, maybe.
Yeah. No, I was saying Vidir, but it's Vidir. Yeah, I'm screwing that up. So, for Mount Vidir, dramatic slopes, mountain. What do people need to know about where you guys source your grapes from?
Rugged barrel, I'll say. Spanish, they call it salvaje. It's like this wild. It is. I come prior to Mount Vidir. I was at Outpost, which was on the top tippy top of Howe Mountain, and I thought that was rugged and middle of nowhere. That is like a metropolis compared to at least up there. You had like a gas station, and maybe there was a little grocery store and a post office. Mount Vidir, there's nothing except other vineyards. You know, some homes. People that really value their privacy. It's not easy to get to. But again, you're only, like where I live in Napa, I'm only 20 minutes away, but it feels like, you know, you've been on the road for hours when you get to the destination. So we have three vineyards on Mount Vidir. The highest elevation is Rosenquist. That is, I think we're, the weather station there that we use is at 1500 foot elevation. I think it's at its highest points around 1600. And then the other vineyard that's contiguous to that is called the North Ranch, which is about 1500 elevation to maybe 1000 or 1200. And then just below that is the original Mount Vidir Winery home ranch from the Bernstein family. That is, I think it's like 800 to 1000. They're rugged. Yes, some slopes. I mean, I think the total acreage is maybe 120 acres, but only 40 are plantable. You know, 30% of the 6% of the vineyard, you're unable to plant. Forested. And then the vineyards that are planted, super steep, a lot of attention to erosion control. Even when that happens, we have little landslides all the time. The wine ranch had a landslide we couldn't even access. You had to kind of, you know, we had to bring, you know, bulldozers in to move these rocks so we could get to the vineyard. We had two pretty impressive winters last in 23 and 24. So, we definitely felt it. I mean, it's great, but also you're spending a lot of money on repairs instead of in the vineyard, which is, you know, we're still doing that in the vineyard, but there's a lot. It's like fixing the pipes in your house, electricity. No one sees it, but it's really important. You know, it's not a new paint job or a remodeled kitchen. You know, oh, look at our new bathroom. Like, oh, look at our new pipes. They're in the wall. You can't really see those. So there's a lot of that with our vineyard team's amazing. So they're for sustainability, just safety, and just, you know, protecting and honoring the land. There's so much that goes into that, you know, are not new plants, or, you know, we do that as well, but it's, I'd say rugged. It's very difficult to farm. Most mountainside vineyards are, this one in particular, they're even hard to walk. As you get your steps in, we don't pick at night because it would be a little too dangerous. That's how severe some of the slopes are. You know, we only pick at first light. We're a lot of vineyards in the valley floor, and even some other vineyards on the hills that aren't as dangerous. You can pick at night, but it's just not, it's not an option. It's not worth, it'd be great, but it's not worth the risk involved. Shallow soils, more like ancient seabed than volcanic. You know, there's sandy loam, kind of gray looking soils. There is some excellent rock content on a couple spots in our vineyards. But I mean, it's selfishly, I love going up. It's just beautiful. Like, you look at it intrinsically, it is, you would love it just because, you know, it's a beautiful place to work.
How would you describe, and again, for people wondering about sometimes the costs of California, specifically mountain wine, That's where a lot of it goes into, is bulldozing, is reinforcing just the amount of infrastructure required to grow the grapes. How would you describe what Vidre Cabernet Sauvignon is all about?
For me, I love the mountain wines, and wasn't new to Mount Vidre. I worked with a client that we would that I made wine for. He was in a little different, a little lower elevation. I love the ruggedness, and it kind of shows in the wine. This kind of feral quality, where it's not, I guess, whatever your philosophy is or your impact as a winemaker, there's not a whole lot you can do as far as like you're not gonna outcompete the terroir of the place, you know, unless you pick it ridiculously early or ridiculously late, you know, that impact. But I think no matter if you're on a little bit on the earlier side, the later side, the AVA shines through with, it's kind of this, it's not overly, it's hard to tease out the fruit, you know, even if it does get ripe, it doesn't lend itself to these big fruity, juicy wines. There's enough generosity there to kind of buffer the tannin and the structure. There's usually real easy to get the color out of it because the smaller berries, hopefully thicker skins. It just, you know, on the farming side, we're just kind of riding the knife's edge there of, we'll say, struggling and stress, but not too far where the plants are unhealthy. You want to, you know, still have a healthy plant, but with a little stress. So we're trying to get, you know, healthy plants, healthy fruit, but we only get maybe 1.5 to 2 tons an acre. That brings the price up. But for Cabernet, I just like it's like a medicinal, a little bit of a medicinal quality on the Cabernet.
I heard this quote, or I read this quote of yours. Uh-oh. You talked about, one of the most important things for me is to honor the Bernstein's original vision, the original owners. With the replanting, we're not creating new vineyards, and we're keeping the footprint just with better plant material. I was wondering if you could sort of expand on that quote and the importance of that for you.
So for that ranch, we're not coming in, and it's slowly being replanted. We had a big kind of landslide there that we're trying to figure out what direction we'll take on that affected area. But the other blocks are, I would say we came in and you can come in and like bulldoze it and re-amend everything or amend and kind of carve, you know, put your stamp on that and kind of just carve out the side of the hill as far as the county would let you. But all we did was replace the existing vineyards where we have replanted with just like newer, more modern rootstock and clonal material that is, you know, it wasn't even around when they planted. So that's kind of, you know, keeping the same shape, maybe the row orientation changes a little bit, but not kind of coming in and just reimagining the entire vineyard. And I think that's important.
The history of the Bernstein family, the history of Vidre, and goes back to friendships with Robert Mondavin, I believe the first vintners to plant Petit Verdot. I mean, Mount Vidre Winery, that's a pretty big history and a pretty big part of the story of California Cab.
Yeah, we just, so the 2023 vintage was the 50th anniversary. So that was some coming on, because that's my first vintage start to finish. Came on in kind of the summer of 23. We just bottled those wines. So that was really exciting for me because that's kind of first wines start to finish. And that was the 50th anniversary. So just something that's been around any business for 50 years, let alone farming. Yeah. And with the, if I use this word right, the vagaries of the marketplace and, you know, the wine drinkers and how tastes change, that, you know, it's still around. Now it has it wasn't neglected, but there's more focus on it now. There's definitely more focus with starting in the vineyard. Vineyard team's amazing. So that's really, I'm super excited about that. And then, you know, just as more eyes on it and more of a push to, you know, keep, kind of want to respect it and keep it land its rightful place in Napa, but also if we can elevate it in any way, hopefully that's what I can do. And it's definitely helps with our vineyard team. It's going to make my job pretty, not simple, but not easy, but simple. Let's put it that way.
Well, that must be a cool honor just for you and the part you're playing to help shepherd with the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. And it's, so I learned, I mean, I knew about Mount Vidre Winery in the Valley, you know, it was always, whether it's the reserve wine or the Napa Valley bottling, it always kind of punched above its weight. You were somewhere and you weren't sure, what wine to pull from the wine list, and depending who you're with, that was always an easy go-to. And then the reserve part of the winery, yeah, they're up there in 64, I think was the purchase, 65, like the first few plants. And I guess the most impressive part to me is they were planting about 1 acre a year, because they didn't have, it's a big investment. And you look at the valley, okay, so you're in Napa or anywhere in 1965. I mean, it's hard to, so the way I'll explain that, it's hard to plant there now with all the modern technology, but like the road washed out. You can't even get in from one way. So it doesn't matter if it's 1965 or 2025. The doesn't really, not some certain parts of that area of the AVA, Mount Veeder, is not changed all that much. So it was really a struggle. It's a struggle now. And then back then they were pulling out they had some cows, and they had like a prune orchard. And so they were just chunking out kind of 1 acre at a time, because that's what they could pull off. That's what they can afford. You got to bring all the materials up there, and this is like forever ago. I wasn't born yet, which is kind of cool. I'm pretty old, but I wasn't born.
That's a labor of love. Jesus,
Just to see that, like that vision and just the dedication. And that's when he was a trademark lawyer. They were living in Berkeley, and then sometime in the 70s, they came up and lived full time. And a little fun fact that I like to share is they actually both worked in the tasting room at Robert Mondavi at one point.
It's a great story. And for people, they can Google it. It's the story of the Bernstein family and Veeder. It's a really cool one. And you just filling in the gaps about doing it 1 acre at a time 50 years ago would have been so hard. If we flash forward to today, one thing I noticed, and I think is a great combination, the Mount Veeder Winery and High Camp Flask set. And I love this tagline: every great adventure deserves a toast. As someone who hates camping, for people listening who hate camping, how much does a Veeder Cabernet or your new Merlot, which I'm curious about, how much does a bottle of that help for people that just aren't a big fan of sleeping in a tent?
Well, it will ease the pain of sleeping on a cot, or like I think this is something you can even take like backpacking, like if you really wanted to get out there, because it's say that's really. I'm not much of a car camper. We're introducing our family to that. That's a great opportunity to bring, the flask. It pays respect to the wine. I think they're it's I'd much rather bring it in the flask than just a bottle. And like, especially if like you're gonna backpack something, have that big piece of glass on your back. I think it'll help ease the pain for folks that maybe aren't used to being a little dusty and dirty, and have all the it's bringing like the creature comforts of home camping with you, and keeps the wine safe. If you don't drink it, you can close that thing back up. So see, with a Mount you drinking a Mount Veeder cab, it's going to be good for air is not the enemy on that wine, so that thing would be good for if it doesn't if you don't drink it all the first day. You could definitely tuck back in there in the next day, and it would just be this maybe even better.
As someone who lives in downtown Toronto, I would use it for the movie theater. That's a much better option than right now, where we'll take an empty water bottle. I think your flask is certainly a better option. We only have a couple minutes left. A geeky question: how different is the style of your Cabernet or Cabernet in general now? Because you were talking about how, you're in the restaurant industry in the early 90s. I imagine you've seen the changes of just the philosophy of Napa Cabernet Sauvignon.
Yeah, I would say for me, when I first started, I didn't buy them, but I had access to tastings for some of the culty wines, and most of those were coming from the valley floor. But then in my progression, I was introduced to some mountain wines, or even just off the valley floor hillsides, and then I gravitated towards those. I guess the change I would see, I think at some point. There's that late 90s, they're super opulent, and they would call it the Parker effect if they want to call it that. But I think he did more to raise the quality than steer people in the wrong direction as far as too much, too high alcohol or too much oak. I guess they're maybe a little more restrained or pulled back now than they were when I kind of came into the business. And then we had a a string of good vintages in the late 90s, early 2000s. And then, I would say some of the other vintages, like 2007, everyone loves. I kind of like the 06 and 08 that are the shoulder vintages. Those are more my style. Yeah, I would say a little, I wouldn't, maybe not restrained, but a little more betting the balance swung back into the cab. And now there's so many cabs, there's something for everybody.
Right.
Maybe I guess the change now that I think about it, the core of the Cabernet people running were all pretty, they were more similar than dissimilar, maybe a little more monolithic with, bigger, juicier wines. And I guess everyone, like the knock on them at that time, well, that I remember was that, oh, they're not going to age. The people that were kind of anti-California cabs, maybe they might still be that way today. But I think that was a myth. They age really well.
Agreed. I think people that say they don't like Napa Cabernet are the same people that say they don't like Chardonnay, but then they ask for a glass of Chablis. There's so much good Cabernet out there. For you guys, you mentioned value. I agree. Your wines consistently punch above the price. And John, really appreciate you coming on the podcast today.
Oh, this
It's
was
a
fun.
cool, it's a really cool story. You started a little bit late, but you're doing fantastic work at Vedder, and I appreciate you doing the pod.
Can I a little shameless plug right now?
Do it.
Well, the scores just came out from Wine Spectator.
Yeah.
The cap, the 90, the 2022 Mount Vedder Reserve, I think got 93 points. And I think the high for the vintage might have been 95 for somebody. Like 93, 94 is like the upper tier. So
Yeah.
I was pretty excited about that.
Congratulations. Great plug right at the end. Well
Yeah.
deserved. No, seriously, congratulations. That's fantastic. Testament to you, to your team, the viticulture, the vinification. John, thanks so much for being on the pod.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks,
It's been
everyone, for
fantastic.
listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Remember, you can find me on iTunes, Apple, iHeart, and wherever quality podcasts are sold.
Thanks for listening to the Matt Talks Wine and Stuff with Interesting People podcast. Happy hunting.